Good afternoon. Today is Friday, April 11th, 2008. I'm Allison Page with the UW-Madison Oral History Program, and today I will be interviewing Kent Kirk about his remembrances and stories of the Forest Products Lab. Mr. Kirk, if you would like to start with maybe a background in where you grew up, your academic history, and what led you to work at the Forest Products Lab.
Okay, I grew up in a small town in northwest Louisiana, and grew up liking trees and wood, so I decided to get a major in forestry for my undergraduate degree. And I did that at what was then Louisiana Polytechnic Institute. I think it's Louisiana Tech University now. And in the course of that bachelor's degree program, I decided I really did not want to be a forester, in part because of spending 2 summers working in the woods as a forester. Maybe it was 3. Anyway, it was not fun. It might be more fun in Wisconsin, but in Louisiana in the summertime in the woods, that's kind of off-putting. So I decided to go to graduate school, and I decided that I really liked to study or to know about the diseases of trees. And so I went to North Carolina State University and got a master's degree with a very well-known plant pathologist, not a forest pathologist, but he was in charge of that program, Arthur Kelman. And I worked on a disease that was then thought to be very serious in the southeastern part of the United States. Turned out not to be so important. But in the course of that master's degree, I decided that I didn't want to work for anybody else, so that I had to get a PhD if I wanted to avoid that and be my own boss. So I stayed on it at North Carolina State, and Arthur, 1 year into my PhD program, decided to come to Wisconsin and became a chair of a department here, a plant pathology department. And Ellis Colling moved down to Raleigh from Yale and became my major professor. And about that same time, Ellis was a graduate, by the way, of Wisconsin. About that same time, I decided that I wouldn't get very far with just biological background, and I decided to stay an extra year and get a PhD also in biochemistry. And that entailed taking a lot of courses that I should have taken as an undergraduate, like physical chemistry and such things. But it was worth it. So at that point, I had a knowledge of forestry and wood, a knowledge of the microorganisms that cause disease of trees and that decay trees or wood. And then I had a strong background in chemistry, or strong, I thought anyway, certainly a lot stronger than most people in plant pathology get. So I graduated with a double PhD, and then I went to stayed on at NC State for 6 months while my then wife finished her bachelor's degree. And then we family moved to Göteborg, Sweden, and I did a postdoc there. I did a postdoc during the 6 months I was still at NC State too. It was in polymer chemistry. And then I went to Chalmers Technical University in Sweden, worked under a world famous professor whose name was Erik Adler, and had a wonderful time there. Stayed a year and a half.
What year around?
Oh, yeah.
What time period is this?
Well, the bachelor's degree was 62, the master's degree was 64, and the PhD was 67. And that postdoc was 68, and the Sweden was mid-68 and all of 69. Now, during the time that I was a graduate student at NC State, I had the opportunity to come up here to the Forest Products Lab for a summer. And that was a very good experience. I came up to synthesize some compounds for my doctoral research in Raleigh. And that worked. And I learned a lot of hands-on organic chemistry up here and was very impressed with the place. It had a good reputation. One of your questions there, the Forest Products Lab had an excellent reputation. At that time, 1966, it was 56 years old, I guess. Now it's nearing 100, it's hard to believe. Anyway, in Sweden, too, I just worked in the lab and learned a lot of organic chemistry techniques. So at that point, I had some knowledge, and I worked on one of the components of wood, lignin, in Sweden. That's why I went to this professor's laboratory. He had a big group there, and I have some good friends going back in August. Anyway, at that point then, when I was looking for a job in 69, jobs were scarce in the United States. And so I first considered staying in Sweden, which I like very much, still do. And then I just wrote to the people I had known here in Madison, asking if they had the possibility of a job. And I got a very nice letter back from one of the assistant directors. It was called a division chief then, I think, Alan Fries, offering me a job. And so from Sweden, I made a trip back to, or the family did, back to Raleigh to pick up a bunch of our stuff, and then to Louisiana to say hello to our families, and then drove up to Madison, and it was minus 15 degrees when we got to Madison on January the 11th or 12th or something like that in 1970. So that's when I started working here full time. I'll let you ask another question now, so don't ramble.
Going back to that summer that you spent up here in 66, mm-hmm. I think you said?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. What kind of work did you do during that summer?
I worked in the laboratory of Clarence Pugh, who was a lignin chemist working at Forest Products Lab, and pretty well known himself. And in that laboratory, he had a technician, Bill Connors, and I worked with Bill. And I had come up here to synthesize a compound, a lignin-related compound, and Bill and I made the compound, and I learned a lot about practical organic chemistry with him. So it was a very valuable summer, and the weather in Madison that summer was absolutely perfect, and I couldn't get over how much of a contrast with Louisiana and Raleigh that summer had been. Okay. So anyway, I didn't hesitate to come back to Madison, you know, even though I was a Southerner, and I haven't ever left.
Do you have any memories that you have of your first couple days on the job in 1970, and who you worked with?
Yeah, they put me into a wood decay group, or it was actually wood deterioration. I forget the exact name of it now. But microbiology, anyway, dealing with decay and its practical aspects of wood decay. And you might know that the fungi that decompose wood are responsible. They're probably the main component of the Earth's carbon cycle as far as decomposing things, because most of the carbon is tied up in wood and other related biomass. Anyway, that was important work, but it didn't interest me much. There wasn't any chemistry to speak of. But there were some good people there. Clark. And Wally Eslin was running the group. Glenn Essenther was there. All well-known wood types. Essenther was an entomologist, so he studied termites and things like that. Mm-hmm. But I was not happy, and after about, well, you said the first 2 days, I was overwhelmed the first 2 days, of course. I just was learning things, not just the first 2 days, but probably the first 2 months. And I did some cooperative work with Wally Eslin, and I don't remember when the mycology group moved from Maryland to the Forest Products Lab, but later I worked with some of those guys as well. They're all mycologists, and therefore no fungi. Anyway, I requested a transfer to a chemistry oriented group here at the Forest Products Lab, and they put me in the project research work unit of Jack Rowe, which was, those guys dealt with, the scientists dealt with wood extractives primarily. And so I went into that group with the idea of trying something new using the fungi that know how to decompose wood beneficially rather than trying to fight them. And so things like biological pulping of wood or using the enzymes that these fungi produce to convert wood or wood components into other products was the focus of my research under Jack Rowe. One of the things that made working at the Forest Products Lab so enjoyable and productive were the services that were available. Particularly in my case, the analytical chemistry group, the editorial group, the photography group, later a computing group, and just all kinds of, and statistics. All of these services made the scientist's life a lot easier at Forest Products Lab than it would be at a university, for example. Universities don't have those services, or some of them do, but and some of them have some of the services. But FPL really had a lot of services, making it possible to use my time much more productively, mm-hmm. rather than trying to analyze some chemical to send it upstairs and let them analyze it and for me to plan the next experiment or whatever.
And which of these services did you use quite a bit? And to what extent?
Well, every time I published a paper, I wrote a paper for publication, and in the end there were about 200 publications. It had to go through editing first. Oh, there was a graphics art group too that could do illustrations for whatever. Just a real nice service. So going through editing happened a lot. And you work with an editor until you got your paper in shape for publication. Universities don't have that kind of thing either, so that everything is, all the T's are crossed and the I's dotted by the time the paper's ready and it's in the right format for the journal. And I actually, by that time, had gotten divorced and I married one of the editors. So that's what I thought about them. And she kept editing my papers and worked out fine. The service I used most was probably analytical chemistry. Back in those days, it's hard to believe it now, but they would analyze wood components using techniques that to us seem really archaic, but they worked beautifully, including paper chromatography, for example. Now that hasn't been used. It isn't used anymore, to my knowledge. But they used it quantitatively and very, very accurately. In fact, that group, that analytical chemistry group, was the world standard, as far as I know. Unfortunately, they never published their procedures, a book of their procedures, but I think some of it has been published now. And of course, some of it would be way out of date now, even if they had published it. What would you like to hear next?
Well, I was kind of wondering a little bit about the types of publications that you did. Mm-hmm. What type of content or topics you covered in your publications? I know you said you did about roughly 200 or mm-hmm. so, but...
That's a good question. Well, my whole career ended up being spent on how lignin is converted back to CO2 in water. And we set out looking at partially degraded lignin that had been that had been attacked by wood decay fungi, and we characterized it chemically and physically. That was the first step, the chemistry of the lignin degradation, lignin biodegradation. Then the next step was to answer the question, okay, we know fungi decompose lignin, but what about other microorganisms, what about bacteria? And ended up, you can't answer that question with current or with the techniques that were available then. So I backed up and synthesized radioactive lignin. And so with the radioactive lignin, carbon-14 labeled lignin, we were able to put that lignin in cultures of whatever, fungi or a soil sample or whatever, and look for radioactive CO2, which meant that something in there was able to decompose the lignin all the way back to carbon dioxide. And with that assay, we were unable to find any bacterial decomposition of lignin. And to this day, it doesn't occur, even though some people say it does. We also found that in the absence of oxygen, lignin does not decay. A lot of things do, of course, in sewage treatment plants and all of that kind of environment, landfills. So oxygen is not necessary for the decomposition of biomass, but it is of lignin. I started having graduate students from the university. I got a university appointment about 1982 in the Department of Bacteriology. And still have it. I'm now an emeritus professor of bacteriology. So I was able to get graduate students. And even more importantly, I was able to get postdocs funded by grants obtained through the university, and eventually, because of the radioactive lignin assay, our program attracted a lot of visiting scientists from other labs around the world. So I don't know how many visiting scientists I had. I would have to look that up, but I'm sure it was at least 30 through the years, and they would stay for anywhere from 1 month to a year. The postdocs, probably had 20 of them, and I think I was the major professor for 12 graduate students through bacteriology. So you ask about publications. One of the jobs of a scientist is to divide the question into discrete packages so that it lends itself to getting an answer and putting a little part of the story together for publication. Scientific journals don't publish great long papers. They probably average 5 pages in a printed journal. I don't know how many bytes that is. But anyway, so dividing the work up into discrete packages like that. For example, the synthesis of the radioactive lignin and demonstration that the lignin-degrading fungi could convert it to CO2, radioactive CO2, was a discrete package, and that was a publication. The study of the chemistry of what we could learn of the chemistry by studying the degraded lignin early on in the 70s made 3 discrete packages. I published very few papers by myself. Was questioned by the Forest Service why that was the case, but nobody did, and certainly nobody does anymore, very rarely. So I worked with scientists all over the world, not just the ones who were in my lab, but we would divide one of our discrete packages questions up, and somebody in Sweden might do half of it, and I would do half of it here, and we would write the paper together. And so I probably worked with, well over 100 co-authors, probably 200 or more co-authors on these publications. And in biology, it is the custom that the leader of the group put his name last on the publication, the list of authors. Usually the graduate student goes first, and then, but in biology, the senior guy goes at the end. And the Forest Service kept questioning me about why wasn't I senior author on any of my papers. We finally got that straightened out because, of course, it wasn't just I, it was everybody in biology who was doing research. Mm-hmm. So, why don't you prompt me here with another?
Well, you said that you got an appointment with the university, so you still worked with the Forest Products Lab at that time. What was it like trying to manage your relationship with the university and your job at Forest Products?
You're right. I was paid all the time by the Forest Products Laboratory until I retired, actually, and then I was paid by the university for 3 years. But I went through the tenure review process and was actually a bona fide associate professor and then full professor. So I did that. Your question, it was not easy because the lab seemed to have an increasing number of meetings, or maybe it was my position that was changing and I had to go to meetings here that I'd much rather be doing research. And the university has even more meetings than the lab. So I would attend a faculty meeting periodically, but I really wasn't concerned with most of the things that they discussed. Some things I was, of course, but most of it concerned assignment of rooms or whatever, how to respond to a review or something like that. So I didn't spend as much time over there as I could have. It was not physically possible. But of course, when I was major professor of a student, then I would have to call the graduate student committee meetings and run the meetings. So that took some time. Probably was worth it, though, because graduate students here at Wisconsin are always very smart, and we're very good for our program. Did I answer your question?
Well, I was wondering how the Forest Products Lab felt, or if you could have any idea of how the lab felt about your work with UW?
Yeah, they didn't like it. It was a constant battle, and it still is, I understand, from my former colleagues. The Forest Service Research Laboratories are very often associated with the university, and the same thing has been true for all of those laboratories. That they're uncomfortable with the association with the universities. But I'll tell you, having the association with the university, this is a great university, and having that association was worth the hassle. And it was a constant attempt, you know, to get how do you get around this rule or regulation? For example, we weren't allowed, no government employee was allowed to get NSF grants, but through the university it was possible to get federal grants like that. And I don't know if that's changed or not, but I kind of doubt it. But our progress in research was so fast and we were so productive that I don't think the Forest Service administrators could argue too much with the way we were doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a perceptive question. Maybe you've heard it before from somebody else. That's kind of a comment.
Well, I was just wondering. Because
it seems like two jobs.
Yeah, and trying to find a balance and that kind of thing. Changing gears a little bit, could you describe maybe a typical day of work here at the lab? What kind of things you would do?
Yeah, during my career at the Forest Products Lab, my day would start before the kids got up. It started about 4 o'clock in the morning with a cup of coffee and a notebook, and I would plan the work that I wanted to get done that day. Sometimes I would read scientific papers, other times I would write scientific papers. But so my day started early, and I pooped out early in the afternoon as well. But a typical day then would be to come to work. I always had a technician, by the way. That was another big advantage of this lab. We had each had a full-time technician, and I would give the technician or in some cases more than one, instructions for what I wanted to try to get done that day. And then turn them loose. And usually go back to the office and do some more writing or reading, or talking to colleagues. Or in those days, we would have to write letters to communicate with foreign associates. So I had a lot of office work. But as often as I could in those early days, I would be back in the laboratory doing work. And one of the things that people don't realize who are not microbiologists is that they don't stop growing at night and on the weekends. They keep doing what they're doing. For example, converting radioactive lignin to radioactive CO2. And it was necessary for years to come in after hours and on the weekends and flush the CO2 out of cultures and put more oxygen in and stuff, that kind of thing. Or to start an experiment that needed to go for a certain number of days. And so I spent a lot of time in here on the weekends and in the evenings when in other fields that's not necessary. So I really didn't feel bad about, and I didn't never ask the technicians to come in, although some of them did. Maybe I did ask them once or twice, but anyway, they didn't complain. It was fun. I lost my train of thought, so. Or you said typical day. It was just office and lab. And later on, when I got into a more administrative type position, I would have some of these onerous meetings that I mentioned to you. And once a week, I had my group. By then, I had several scientists, and they had technicians. And we, at one point, had 50, you know, a staff of 50. That was as big as it got. But we had seminars once a week within our group, or we would invite somebody from outside to come in and give a seminar, somebody from the university, for example. And that was for the sake of the graduate students, because all of us scientists had graduate students. By then, we were known as the Institute for Microbial and Biochemical Technology. So that's what connected us. We had an expert on the fermentation of 5-carbon sugars, Tom Jeffries. He's still here, and he is a world leader in that field. Ken Hamill is here. He's an expert on the subject that kept me busy for so many years, lignin biodegradation. I would say he knows more about it than anybody else in the world right now, including me. And then we hired Dan Cullen later on. Dan is a molecular geneticist and has just done a splendid job of working out the molecular genetics of these wood decay organisms. And he's worked with a variety of other people and so forth. So, and at one point we had another NC State graduate, Rich Lamar, who has since moved on, but he is a very hardworking fellow. And his interest, he was a soil scientist, and his interest was in bioremediation. And so we discovered that these lignin-degrading fungi can also degrade a wide variety of pollutants. And so not only were we thinking about things like biopulping, which is an obvious one, but we were thinking of soil remediation. And we were thinking of decolorizing lignin-derived wastes from pulp mills, bleach plants, and biopulping as well, and fermentation of 5-carbon sugars, which Tom has really taken the lead in. So we had both sides of the research, the types of research. We had the practical applications, which the Forest Service was very interested in, and that's how you sell your program, and the basic aspects like the radioactive lignin, you know, what are the enzymes that decompose lignin. And we eventually discovered a lignin-degrading enzyme the first one. And one of your questions on your sheet had to be, what's one of the highlights of your... That was one of them. One of them, I can tell you a story that that illustrates serendipity in research. When we first made the radioactive lignin and sprinkled it into some liquid cultures of lignin-degrading fungi, the radioactive lignin was ignored. It was not decomposed to CO2. And we tried everything that we could think of. The fungi would grow fine, but they would not touch this lignin. At that point, we knew the lignin was okay. I mean, it was synthesized in the laboratory, but we knew it was authentic enough because if we sprinkled it on a little piece of wood and then decayed the wood, CO2 would come off. But why in these liquid cultures would it, which is the way you study microorganisms, why wouldn't it happen? And one day, this was a complicated culture medium. One day, my technician made up the culture medium with 1/10 the amount of nutrient nitrogen that was supposed to be in there. That's an easy mistake to make. You just pick up the wrong pipette. And those cultures just blew the CO2 off of this radioactive lignin. For the first time, that worked. And we didn't, of course, know why all of a sudden it started working. But we could see that the fungi in those cultures were not very happy. They weren't growing very well. And so we suspected that there's something missing from the medium, and that's what proved to be the case. I mean, that is pure serendipity. Mm-hmm. And from that point on, it was much easier to work with the fungi. And the reason that the nitrogen was important, the low level of nitrogen, triggers what's called secondary metabolism in fungi. And these fungi have to be in a secondary metabolic state before they will degrade lignin. And nobody knows to this day why that's the case. That's when other fungi will produce antibiotics and all kinds of complicated chemicals. But why lignin biodegradation should be tied to it, to that phase, is not yet clear. But it is, and that was fun. It was a lot of fun. Just the time to track that down, or the time that we did, that was a lot of fun. See that carbon dioxide come off for the first time.
What kind of reaction did you get from FPL in general, or the community, when you published or made your research known?
Oh, how to answer that? I got a lot of awards and honors, and they were write-ups in the newspaper. That was another thing that the lab did. If you accomplished something, you'd get an award or something, you would get written up. You know, they'd send a write-up to the Cap Times or the State Journal. So that, as far as the community was concerned, that was a little bit of press that way, but the honors meant a lot to me. It was that outside groups were showing appreciation for the research, as well as the Forest Service, of course. I was treated very generously by the Forest Service. And the paper describing the carbon-14 lignin really got a lot of attention. The last time I checked, you can check with the Institute of Scientific Information. I think it's still extant. And you can see who is citing your papers in their subsequent papers. Mm. So you can go and get an idea of what kind of an impact your papers are having. And the last time I checked, mine had been cited over 10,000 times by others. Mm-hmm. So that's a lot. And I could take that information and give it to the Forest Service and say, look, my research might not seem too practical, but it's getting a lot of attention. It's important to others. So that is one way that we discovered, and not just mine, but the other guys in the group as well. Mm-hmm. So we learned to justify our basic research that way.
Well, I know that you did work here at the lab, and you also did work with the university.
Mm-hmm.
Did your work take you elsewhere outside of either the state or the city?
I traveled a lot, yeah. Mm-hmm. I've traveled so much as part of my job that I don't really enjoy traveling that much anymore. Europe several times. I was the external examiner on Swedish PhDs, I think, four times. And probably went back to Sweden every year for the first 30 years after I was a postdoc there. Everywhere trees grow pretty much, and where there are laboratories studying them, you know, it's Pacific Northwest. And I've been to every state except Arizona. I don't think they've got a forest products lab there, but I'll get there. And I did a sabbatical in Japan in 1979 and early 80, I think. And I worked there in the laboratory. I got away from administrative type stuff for 8 months and just worked. I had a specific objective and worked with a fellow who was very good at that kind of work, and we got it done. So, scientists always have interesting international meetings. I organized some of those myself, but others certainly did and continue to do so. So Paris and Hamburg, Raleigh, New Zealand, lots of different places where those meetings were held. And then there are annual meetings of the American Chemical Society and Technical Association of the Pulp and Paper Industry and other things like that. I also served as an officer in the International Academy of Wood Science, ending up as president, and that would take me to other countries. So yeah, I travel more than I. Mm-hmm. I vowed never to go back to Asia again, mm-hmm. but maybe you shouldn't print that. Okay.
What was one of your most interesting or most memorable instances of working abroad with other scientists?
Well, I didn't do a lot of that. I did that in as a postdoc in Sweden, and I had a lot of fun. So the memories of that, of working in that organic chemistry department at Chalmers University in Sweden, are very good ones. We worked so hard in Japan that, and I learned a lot from the fellow I was working with, those are pleasant memories. And then we lived in Kyoto, so that's a pleasant city to be in, and lots to see. So, memories here, I had so many good experiences here with the research, and until the end of my career, toward the end of my career, very strong support by the administrators at the Forest Products Lab. That was not the case at the time I retired, and that's one reason I left. Another reason was that my wife had been diagnosed with colon cancer, and so and I had accomplished what I wanted to accomplish. So I just, as far as research is concerned, so I took early retirement and helped her for another year and a half, and then she died. And as I said, I continued with the university for a little while. That was part-time, though. Taught a course over there with Ken Hamill and Dan Cullen for, I don't know, 5 years toward the end of my career. And then a little bit after I retired from here.
Well, if you would like to describe a little bit about your time here towards the end of your career, kind mm-hmm. of some of the struggles you had or reasons why you decided to leave, go into a little bit more about that if you are comfortable.
Well, I think a more important thing to get down is concern some of the awards that I was lucky enough to receive. One of them was the Marcus Wallenberg Prize, I was the first American to get that award. It was given out in some very fancy ceremonies by the King of Sweden in Falun, Sweden. And that's a prize for forestry-related research. I shared it with a fellow, a Swede, who died last week, actually. And that was a wonderful experience, getting that award. And it was a great honor. Another Forest Service scientist has now gotten that award, and I think a third might have gotten it. I kind of lost track of it, because there's in different fields of forestry, and some of them I don't understand. Also, I was elected to the National Academy of Sciences in 1988, and I'm only the second Forest Service scientist to have been elected to the Academy. So that was really, really a high point of my short career. And it was, it still is a very pleasant organization to belong to and to go to the meetings and so forth. I think part of the reason I got the even nominated for the Academy or the Wallenberg Prize or any of these others is because of the administrators at the laboratory were interested in getting their people recognized. Particularly, I can imagine that John Koning, who was my assistant director, and therefore he was my supervisor for several years until he retired, I was very good about putting people in for awards. And the election to the Academy came as such a total surprise to me that I was absolutely overwhelmed. And it's not easy to keep those things secret. I know, because I've nominated people since then, and it's not easy. The Wallenberg Prize, I had gotten some hints about that, because it just leaks out, because that's a forestry related one, and it gets around the world of forestry. So the dissatisfaction at the end of my career, you probably would hear that from other people if you asked. We had a director here who came from Washington after I don't know how many years as a bureaucrat, and he didn't seem to me to have much interest in research. And really couldn't talk with him about research. It was totally different from the previous directors I'd served under. Then they hired a fellow from industry who came here as deputy director, and he really didn't know anything about research. So that was a big disappointment to me. It seemed to me that, you know, the emphasis was on civil rights, it was on budget, it was on union matters, it was on all kinds of things but research, and it wasn't fun anymore. So I was lucky that I could just get out.
Did you notice some actual, besides maybe the emphasis by administrators, did you notice any actual like changes within the lab in terms of number of employees or
it's gone down steadily, the number of employees. You see, you walk around these buildings and you see a lot of empty space, and of course that's not something that is under the control of the director of the Forest Products Laboratory, but to some extent it is, because he competes, or she competes, with the other directors of Forest Service stations. Mm-hmm. And I think there are 8 of them. And there's a finite pot of money, and it's divvied up. So to that extent, the director has been responsible for the lowering of the number of scientists and engineers here. And I don't, for the life of me, understand why they're building a new building out front. The staff numbers have been going down. There must be a reason for that. Well, I'll tell you what. Oh, I've got 15 more minutes, but I'm going to have to go at 11:30.
Okay, that's fine.
So ask me the ones you really want to know.
Okay. I guess the last part that I really wanted to kind of capture was any memories that you have about specific people at the lab and overall general perceptions of the lab during your time here.
Yeah, I had several good friends. They still are good friends at the Forest Products Lab. Some of them I worked with, and some of them were in other groups. Some of them were at the university. So having that close camaraderie it was important. That was fun. I enjoyed very much working with some of my postdocs. In particular, Ming Tian, who came to me with a PhD in biochemistry from Michigan State, and Rich Lamar came to me with a PhD in soil science from NC State. Ken Hamel, who came from Germany, he was doing a postdoc in Germany when we hired him. And several, I'm not doing some of the others justice because I can't remember their names, but I really very much enjoyed working with those guys and planning experiments and trying to interpret results. And several scientists in other universities or laboratories I really enjoyed working with. Homin Chang at North Carolina State, who I did not know when I was there, he came after I left. He's a professor, or was a professor of wood and paper science there, I think that's the name of it. And we published a lot of papers together, practical and basic aspects of our work. Etienne Odier in Paris was a French guy that, obviously, that I really enjoyed working with. He spent time here, and we published some papers together. I had a lot of fun working with some of the technicians. Mike Mozak in particular, he and I had a lot of fun making compounds and making things work, growing up cultures and such things. I enjoyed working with John Koning, my supervisor, because he was such a generous administrator. He just worked for his people, and that is not always the case. So he tried very hard to protect his scientists from all of the petty nonsense that you get in any place, you know, whether it's industry or university or federal lab. And he did a good job of forming a good barrier for that kind of stuff. So I guess working with people was the most enjoyable thing. There are a lot of those light going on moments when the research was just a high point of the day. Mm-hmm. And let's see. One thing about this lab, it's all focused on forest products or wood. And so in contrast to a university, you could walk around the lab and find somebody who's an expert on whatever question you have at the moment. There were some very good wood chemists at the lab, and I consulted with them many times, and even engineers on occasion to figure out how to do something. One of the things that we did toward the end of my career was we worked on a practical process for biopulping, for pulping wood with fungi. When wood is pulped chemically, the process just takes out the lignin, leaving the cellulose. That's basically it. So the question was, can we just take these lignin-degrading fungi and remove the lignin and leave the cellulose there? Well, the answer is you can't get all the lignin out. And the reason for that is that the lignin degradation is not self-supporting. It has, the fungus has to eat some sugars in order to degrade the lignin. It can't get energy out of lignin. So when you biopulp, you take out, you can have a selective fungus that will take out a lot of the lignin, but also will eat some of the sugars, the hemicellulosis, mainly. And that was scaled, that worked in the lab, and what it did was it reduced the energy, this is fungal treatment, reduced the energy required for making a pulp mechanically. That's another way that newspapers, for example, newsprint is made, just mechanically. Mm-hmm. And it reduced the energy for that by 30%. And that process was taken to the 50-ton scale, and that's a big pile of wood chips. And that, a photograph of that should be in there. If you have photographs in your book, that should be in there. And that was done several times, but it never became commercialized. Mm-hmm. Another thing that was done on a, well, let me back up and tell you that the reason it didn't become commercialized illustrates a point. The pulp and paper industry is very conservative. And they hire chemical engineers mainly, and civil engineers. They don't have anybody who speaks biology. And so almost any process that requires some knowledge of biology is over their heads, or they don't have the background to understand it. And so biopulping, though it works very well and economics look great, is not commercial. Maybe it will with energy prices so high now. This is certainly going to be something worth looking at again. Although I don't know who's going to do it now. It's not studied here anymore. The work is done. We have patents. The bioremediation of soils, the work of Rich Lamar, was taken to a large scale also. And in that procedure, the fungi, whatever you're using, which one you're using, there's several of them will work. Grown up on pellets, and then the pellets are mixed in with the contaminated soil, and the fungi grow and degrade the pollutant, the contaminant. That was taken to a large scale, and that actually did become commercial. Unfortunately, under Reagan, it wasn't as important to clean up the environment as it had been before. Mm-hmm. And so the funding fizzled out on that project, but it was briefly commercial for a while. Some sites are still required to be cleaned up. And I don't know the exact status of it anymore, but that was the case at one time. Now, Tom Jeffries, as I said, is the world leader on fermenting 5-carbon sugars. Are you going to interview Tom?
Maybe not. Not yet.
Let me tell you. Anyway, if you take wood and convert it with acid or some other processes, you get a mixture of the lignin and glucose and a 5-carbon sugar named, glucose is 6-carbon, 5-carbon sugar named xylose. And it's about 25% lignin, 25% xylose, and 50% glucose. Anyway, obviously if you're going to ferment this mixture of sugars, mm-hmm. the lignin is filtered off and burned or something, but if you're going to ferment the sugars, you've got to be able to ferment 5-carbon sugars. And so plants that have a lot of these 5-carbon sugars, which includes all crop plants and all broadleaf trees, the wood of broadleaf trees, it's very important to be able to convert that. And Tom Jeffries has figured out how to do that. It's a specialized yeast that he's been studying and which actually does it. So there, you can call me if you want to ask any more questions.
Okay. Here's my card. Well, thank you for your time today.